I'm Kevin Bixby, Executive Director of the Southwest Environmental Center, and your host for today's program. Well, the New Mexico Legislature is in full session, mostly on Zoom, and as usual, a huge number of bills have been introduced, including many excellent bills, environmental bills, and some really bad ones, as always, that address wildlife, climate, fracking, and other environmental topics. And more bills are expected to be dropped before the February 18th deadline. And as usual, the legislative process is a mad scramble to get bills heard in committee and to a floor vote in both chambers before the session ends on March 20th. On today's show, I'll be talking with leaders from three New Mexico organizations about some of the bills they are tracking in Santa Fe. My guests are Jessica Johnson, Chief Government Affairs Officer for Animal Protection New Mexico and Animal Protection Voters, Brittany Fallon, Policy Director, New Mexico Wild, and Luis Guerrero, Legislative and Political Organizer with the Sierra Club Rio Grande Chapter. Thank you all for being on the show today. I know with the legislature in session, you are all extremely busy. Before we start talking about specific bills, I want to get a sense of how the legislature is operating this session. The coronavirus pandemic is still raging with the specter of more infectious variants looming. And the Santa Fe New Mexican reported yesterday that a Republican House member, as well as four Capitol staff, have tested positive for COVID-19. Jessica, you've been working the Roundhouse for many years. What is it like this year? How are they operating?
Thanks, Kevin, for that question. The word that I keep hearing from almost everyone, from lobbyists to legislators alike, is strange. It is a very strange session. And I think it's been interesting to see the tension between wanting to, of course, move ahead as scheduled and conduct the people's business during the 60-day legislative session that is on the calendar, but also keeping people safe. Some of those safety measures have really impacted how everyone in the public, including lobbyists, are allowed to make their voices heard and stake their positions on the issues being debated in the legislature. And I think there have been some pros and cons. You know, you can hear arguments saying that the virtual session restrictive to people and fewer people can tune in. And then you've heard that from others that the virtual session makes it actually more accessible for the public. And I think it's a little bit of both. It's very difficult right now, but it was also difficult for a lot of people during the traditional sessions because not everyone can spend 12 hours a day in the Capitol building in Santa Fe. When you live in, for example, Southern New Mexico, it's really hard to do that. So it's been strange, but I think for the most part, everyone is doing their best and working in good faith. But it's certainly scary when you start to hear about maybe there are people that aren't being as careful as they should be and people getting sick. It's not great.
Brittany, you're a veteran lobbyist. What are you seeing this year?
I will echo a lot of what Jessica says in that it is certainly very strange. It's very strange to testify for a bill and not be able to look the legislators in the eye. Much more difficult for me as somebody who spends 12 hours a day in the Roundhouse, being able to talk to everybody in person, grab people between committees. You can't do that when it's being hosted via Zoom. But I have noticed that a lot of New Mexico Wild members who might otherwise not be able to participate in the session have been able to sign up for virtual committee meetings, even if they weren't given the chance to speak. And certainly it's nice for me to be able to walk around the house with my AirPods in, listening to a committee meeting and drinking coffee in my pajamas instead of being in a suit in the building at 7 a.m.
For sure. There are some advantages. Luis, how about you?
Yes, I definitely want to echo what everybody has said. My experience has not been so much like actually lobbying in the Roundhouse. usually my work in previous years involved more like the political side and candidates and stuff like that. But I have spent some time in the roundhouse. I mean, I've done public comments, I've done stuff like that. But I will tell you that as somebody that's in Southern New Mexico, I'm in Las Cruces also, it is nice that I don't have to be in Santa Fe for the 60 days. Not that I wouldn't mind being up there, but I mean, like, you know, like, it is nice that I don't have to be there. And I can just be, like, pretty much what Brittany said, just drinking coffee, watching something in one screen, and then on the other screen having whatever else I'm focusing on. That's really nice. Yesterday, I actually had a friend that is getting ready to do a public comment, an upcoming public comment, you know, kind of asked, like, okay, like how is it working? What do I need to do? And so, you know, to me, it's like, I feel like, while yes, it is making it more accessible, at the same time, it's not, you know, like, there's been a lot of group conversations that we're all in where people are still figuring out, okay, well, you know, we can only sign up to 5 people for public comment, or, you know, we have to, like, what do we have to mention, or how do we get into the public comment? And there's a lot of differences between the House and Senate, you know, so I think, you know, in my take, it is great that, you know, that people are able to access it, but the information on how to access it, I think, is what really needs a lot of work.
I was going to echo some of what he just said. There have certainly been a number of technical difficulties this session, and we know that the folks who run the roundhouse are still trying to work out the kinks, which makes it difficult when you only have 60 days to pass legislation. And I wanted to comment on the fact that multiple people have gotten COVID, which puts the entire session at risk, because if COVID continues to spread among staff and legislators, I would expect that they would adjourn for safety reasons, which makes it really, really important for all of us, but particularly legislators and staff who are in the building, to be taking the proper precautions and watching out for each other so that they can continue to do the people's business, because that's what they're there for. And they're there, the legislators at least, in a volunteer capacity. They're not paid to do this job.
Do you think, to that point, do you think it's fair that because some people apparently take wearing masks more seriously than others, that we should shut down, you know, adjourn the legislature because of some people's recklessness or irresponsibility? What do you think, Jessica?
Well, I'll say that, you know, I, for one, hope that the legislature does not adjourn, at least for any significant amount of time. You know, of course, you know, the proper protocols need to be followed. I mean, at this point, I'm sure there are health experts that are, you know, doing contact tracing and everything that they need to do to try to prevent further infections in the roundhouse. But, you know, there's a lot of important things that the legislature is tasked with tackling. And I think it would be a disservice to New Mexicans to just press the pause button for an unknown period of time. You know, there's the budget. There's all kinds of important issues related to revenue and education, you know, really big ticket measures that have been fought for by advocates for years and years and years. And everyone wants, you know, a fair shot during the 2021 legislative session. And so, you know, I think it is important to kind of keep the eye on that ball and make sure that we're not, that the state is not just kind of waving a white flag. We know that if we follow the right health protocols, and we do utilize and continue to learn how to better utilize technologies, a largely virtual legislative session, frustrating as it is, can be done, and it can be done successfully. So that's what I hope to see, but I know that's in the hands of legislative leadership at this point.
I want to point out something else that was in the New Mexican, Santa Fe, New Mexican article that reported on the COVID cases. It said that regular visitors to the roundhouse, including legislative staff and the media, are tested, I believe, weekly, but legislators aren't. I'm not sure why. That wasn't established as a requirement, but and according to the New Mexican, quote, when senators were developing rules ahead of the session, mandatory nasal testing of COVID-19 for lawmakers was a lively topic of discussion. And then there's a quote from Representative Candy Spence Ezell, Republican from Roswell. She said at that meeting on January 6, quote, if you think I'm a threat, folks, stay away from me. But I'll be damned if I'm going to allow somebody to jab a Q-tip up my nose every 5 days. Luis, do you have any response to that?
Yes. yeah. I mean, to me, it's just like anything else with COVID. You know, I mean, there's people that have been taking it serious and have been taking the appropriate precautions. And then there's people that just basically are like, hey, you know what, like stop living in fear or this, you know, this is fake. This is not true. Like, it's not that bad. And I think the fact that, I mean, we are in day 9 of the legislative session. And there's already been, as small as it is, there's already, you know, it's an outbreak, you know, and I mean, it takes a while for symptoms to start showing up. So, I mean, hopefully there's not a lot more people that are sick. I would say my opinion on whether it needs to be, you know, we need to keep doing the session or adjourn is kind of like in the middle. I'm like in the middle of like where Brittany and Jessica stand. I feel like, you know, like we also got to be mindful that, I mean, some people are having to work in the White House. You know, there's a lot of aides and there's a lot of staff members that are working in the Roundhouse that are working in the Roundhouse. And you know, I mean, we also gotta consider their safety and their families. And legislators, to me, should be taking that responsibility. There are, there are quite a few legislators that have been taking those precautions. Like I know Carrie Hamblin posted right at the beginning of the session that, you know, I mean, that she wasn't required to, but she got tested to make sure that her and her colleagues were safe. You know, so it just all comes to personal responsibility. And I do find it unfortunate that the representative from Roswell basically was like, hey, stay away from me. It's like, no, like you need to be mindful of your fellow human beings.
Right. And something else that was in the article said that there, I don't know if this is a new development as a result of the COVID cases that were reported or this was in place at the beginning of the session, but House floor sessions only allow for 3 members of the House to be present at one time. Brian Egoff, who's the Speaker of the House, Townsend, I can't remember his first name, who's the leading the minority leader for the Republicans, and I think Sharon, I don't know, maybe Temple Williams? I'm not sure, but
Stapleton.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. So that's a pretty severe response, but maybe that's what's needed. I'm your host, Kevin Bixby, and today we're talking about legislation up in the Roundhouse in Santa Fe. My guests are Jessica Johnson with Animal Protection of New Mexico, Brittany Fallon, Policy Director for New Mexico Wild, and Luis Guerrero, who's with the Sierra Club Rio Grande chapter. Okay, before the break, we were talking about how COVID and the pandemic have affected the operations of the legislature. Let's talk about specific legislation. Jessica, I'd like to start with you. What are some of Animal Protection of New Mexico's top priorities this session and other issues you'd like to talk about?
Well, one thing that we've also seen coming out of this pandemic is that more and more New Mexicans are out there enjoying our public lands, right? I mean, there's not a lot of things that people can do outside of the house right now because of COVID-19 that is safe. And the safest thing to do outdoors is to just, you know, go out up into the mountains, into the desert, into the woods, and take a walk and, you know, enjoy the scenery, enjoy wildlife. And so then what we've also seen is an uptick in the number of reports that we are hearing of people finding wild animals caught in leg hold traps, finding dead skinned wild animals left out on public lands by trappers, and a growing number of people's dogs being caught in traps or neck snares. So, you know, we are back again this legislative session working on the Wildlife Conservation and Public Safety Act. And a lot of people know it as Roxy's Law, named after a dog named Roxy, who sadly died in a neck snare set on public lands in 2018. And this is, you know, not just our priority. I mean, there are many, many organizations working on this bill, including the Sierra Club and NM Wild. So I know Luis and Brittany can speak to this as well. But what the bill would do, and it's been filed, it's Senate Bill 32, and it's sponsored by Senators Bobby Gonzalez from Rancho State House and Brenda McKenna from Corrales. And then there's also House sponsors, Representatives Matthew McQueen from Galisteo and Christine Chandler from Los Alamos. What the bill would do is it would ban traps, snares, and wildlife poisons on our public lands. There are a list of exceptions in the bill that, you know, are relatively common sense when people look at them, you know, still allowing the devices to be used by governments or professionals in the case of protecting human health and safety, scientific research, ecosystem management, being able to, you know, catch a stray dog in a cage trap so an animal shelter can take it in. You know, there's a lot of these exceptions to make the law workable and fair. But the important thing is that when this bill passes, it will dramatically reduce and almost eliminate the private and commercially driven setting of traps, snares, and poisons on public lands. It will keep people safer, and it will help to conserve our wildlife populations who belong in those habitats on public lands.
Well, let me just play the devil's advocate here. You mentioned that this is a traps and snares are safety hazard for people out on public lands. So I acknowledge that, but what about the trappers? Aren't we going to put them out of business? Don't they need to catch these animals and sell furs to make a living?
So there's a number of factors that come into play to answer that question. One is that, you know, when trappers are trapping to sell the furs to make money, you then have to take a look at the fur market. And the fur market has been slowly and then quickly dying over the past several years. There is an increasing number of fashion houses that have sworn off using fur in their clothing products. And as a result of that, and, you know, and also just changing times, the fur prices have gone down and down and down. The pandemic has basically destroyed it because there was a little bit of a limited ability to sell their furs at auction. And so now they have a huge oversupply of furs for a small and shrinking consumer base for those furs. So, you know, the idea that into the future, this is going to be a substantial source of income for people is simply not true. And, you know, I don't think any of us can speak for any individual person. You know, I don't have my eyes on anyone's bank accounts, but we do have some numbers that we've been able to crunch in looking at the fur prices, the percentage of furs that are usually sold at auctions. And then we know the number of fur bearing animals that are reported as being caught by trappers every year from the Department of Game and Fish. And when you average it out, it comes down to your average trapper making about, you know, maybe $400, $200 to $600, that kind of range on average every year. So, you know, certainly there's going to be some outliers at the top, you know, the really prolific trappers that are taking hundreds of animals off of our public lands and making several thousand dollars. But by and large, you know, this is a hobby. And then there's also a very serious ethical question that New Mexicans are looking at, including sportsmen who hunt game animals with firearms and other devices, to say, hey, wait a minute, why do we live and work and hunt and manage wildlife under this ethic of not commercializing wildlife, but then we have this big gaping exception for fur bearers, where you can take unlimited numbers of bobcats and foxes and badgers, and you can sell their products to make a commercial profit. You can't do that with any other game species under the law. So, you know, I think there's this reckoning of, like, you know, maybe this is completely incorrect how we've been managing our wildlife in New Mexico, and we need to do better.
Yeah, maybe this is a legacy of our frontier days when, you know, people did trap for a living and we didn't have a, you know, the ecological understanding that we have today about the importance of, you know, these massive carnivores in our ecosystems. And let's talk about the effect on individual animals that are trapped, whether they're targeted species like bobcats and foxes, or, you know, just unfortunate victims that happen to step in the trap and get caught. What's that experience like? I've read that trappers say that it's not painful, it doesn't cause injury. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think, you know, if you talk to a non-trapper who's gone through the experience of their own dog being caught in a leg hold trap or a neck snare while on a hike, they will vehemently disagree with the proposition that these devices are just perfectly humane. Luis's organization, Sierra Club, one of his colleagues, Mary Catherine Ray, who lives, you know, as she describes it, out in the hinterlands of Socorro County, she's run into traps multiple times, including her own dog, while on leash on public lands being caught in a trap. And this happened after she'd been working on this issue for many years. So she actually knew how to open a leg hold trap, and it still took her a significant amount of time to release her dog, because dogs in that moment are usually panicked and thrashing and biting.
Right.
Senator Gonzalez, the sponsor of Roxy's Law, was inspired to sponsor this bill because of a little girl in his district walking her dog. The dog got caught in a trap, and as she was nearby, the dog accidentally bit her, and it was just a traumatic experience for the whole family.
And I've heard the audio recording. Mary Catherine had the wherewithal to pull out her phone when her dog was trapped, because she has been working to ban traps for so long. She had her wits about her. And she recorded the audio, not the video, the audio of her dog and her reaction. And it's clear that the dog is in a great deal of fear, stress, anxiety, and probably pain. And Mary Catherine was pretty upset as well. That audio makes quite an impression on you if you have a chance to hear it.
Yeah, it is blood curdling. You know, and you'll hear arguments that, you know, this when we talk about the cruelty and the trauma that people face when they have these experiences, that these are just emotional arguments. So I do want to share that, you know, there is a way to quantify this. There's this wonderful wildlife scientist here in New Mexico, long time, has studied fur bearer species, and he did an examination of studies on leg hold traps, because there have been many studies to look at, you know, what are the numerical indications of pain and injuries that are experienced. And when you actually look at those numbers, they are exorbitantly high. He did the work and did the math and looked at, you know, the number of animals trapped in New Mexico, fur-bearing animals, probably around 10 to 12,000 a year. And about half of them experience what would be considered serious to severe injuries. Half of them. So, that is one way that I'm trying to share with folks that it's not just about feelings of cruelty. There's scientific evidence of unnecessary injury to the animals caught in these devices.
Right. Yeah. and I have personally seen a coyote caught in a trap. It was just horrific. And then, I like to describe these traps, these leg hole traps, as landmines that are set out on the landscape, and they're just waiting for anybody, anything to step on them. And if it's heavy enough to, you know, trigger the trap, it's going to catch that animal. And, full disclosure, last year, I happened to be called out to inspect a place where probably 40 skinned coyotes had been dumped down near the Mexican border near Santa Teresa in Doñana County. And it was horrible and is probably a trapper's dump, legally trapped, probably, we don't know, but illegally dumped. But it's quite an awful sight. I'm your host, Kevin Bixby. My guests today are Jessica Johnson with Animal Protection of New Mexico, Brittany Fallon with New Mexico Wild, Luis Guerrero with the Sierra Club Rio Grande chapter, and we are talking about legislation and the Roundhouse. Before the break, Jessica Johnson was telling us about Roxy's Law, SB 32, a bill that would ban the use of traps, snares, and poisons on public lands in New Mexico. Now let's turn to New Mexico Wild. Brittany, what is one of your New Mexico Wild's priorities for this session?
New Mexico Wild is working on a couple different bills, including Roxy's Law alongside Animal Protection Voters and Sierra Club. But our biggest priority is House Bill 200, which is a bill that designates the Water Trust Board as a successor to the Southwest New Mexico Water Study Group, which sounds super wonky, but in layman's terms, we've got $80 million remaining in the New Mexico Unit Fund now that the Gila diversion has been defunded, thanks to Governor Lujan Grisham. And it's really critical that we use that money and fast track getting the $80 million for urgently needed water infrastructure projects in rural Southwest New Mexico in the four county region. Right now, there's over $137 million in priority water projects in the region that are lining up each year for extremely competitive funding at the Water Trust Board. And we believe that by giving the Water Trust Board the authority to recommend to ISC how to spend the $80 million in the NM Unit Fund, we can alleviate some of that pressure and secure critical water supplies during a time of crisis, create jobs, and streamline funding decisions in a way that is equitable for all water users, whether it's municipal, agricultural, or special districts.
Okay, so let's step back just a little bit. And I know this is an issue with the proposed Gila diversion that's been going on for years. And I'm sure many of our listeners, especially in the Silver City area, will have been following this issue pretty closely. And my fellow host on Earth Matters, Allison Siwick and Donna Stevens, are both very engaged in that issue. But can you tell us what happened to the diversion project? Is it dead for sure?
It's effectively dead. Our current governor opposes it. Most of our federal delegation opposes it. It has missed a number of critical federal deadlines that mean it's no longer feasible. And it's time to move forward with using that money instead to fund local water infrastructure projects that have an enormous backlog of not being funded.
So what would some of those projects be? Can you give us an idea?
Ooh, you know what? I don't have that pulled up right now. But how the, this is a wonky topic. Each year through the state, counties, municipalities, ditch associations, and the like can submit to the state government for capital improvements to fund water infrastructure. And those could be anything from wells to drinking water improvements, wastewater line improvements, canals, storage tanks, all sorts of things. Well upgrades, optimization, all kinds of different, anything you could imagine using water for or needing to transport water into or store water into can be, you can request funding for that through the state, but there's never enough funding to fund the need that there is. And that's especially true for the four county region, Grant, Luna, Hidalgo, and Catron counties.
Among those projects, a diversion would not be included. Is that correct?
That is correct. And in addition to directing the Water Trust Board to oversee how to spend the $80 million on water infrastructure projects in those four counties, it also prohibits the expenditure of this money to evaluate, plan, or construct a Gila River diversion.
And what about the Southwest New Mexico Water Study Group that would be replaced?
Currently, it is the New Mexico CAP entity, which is a group made up of local stakeholders that don't necessarily have technical expertise in water infrastructure, and who, some of whom have been in press at this time as saying they will not spend a dollar of that $80 million on local community projects because they are still interested in pursuing a diversion on the Gila River. And that's just unacceptable during a time where we are in an economic crisis for a variety of reasons. To hold $80 million that's badly needed hostage, when we could be infusing that money into the economy to build water infrastructure that is critical and creating jobs in counties that have up to 15.5% unemployment rate. It's very critical that the legislature work on this and infuse this good money into those counties to bring economic prosperity.
A little wonky, but it sounds really important to finally, you know, inject some sanity in this, into this Arizona New Mexico Water Settlement Act issue that's been going on for so long. What do you think the bill's prospects are of passing?
This year is more, is, I think this year is promising, and that's not only because of the composition of the legislature, but it's also because the legislature has been hearing about this issue for 16 years with $15 million in federal funds that have been wasted pursuing an unfeasible and unaffordable Gila River diversion project. And when I'm talking to legislators, many of them are saying, yes, we've been talking about this for years. What are we waiting for? Let's get that money into the community. And that's especially true because this is the first legislative session where the diversion has been officially defunded and therefore effectively ended. So it's time to move in a new direction.
Bill is a good example of never giving up. I mean, bills might go on for 16 plus years, but when they're important, that the advocates stick behind it and you can still see results. So kudos to New Mexico Wild and all the other groups working on this.
Yeah, and I'll add to that too. I mean, Brittany mentioned like the composition of the Senate and I mean, and the House has greatly transformed in the last 16 years. So, I mean, you know, I mean, this one and other bills, I mean, you know, I feel like they're a little more hopeful than they would have been in sessions past.
How has the complexion of the legislature changed as a result of the election of 2020?
We saw last year, you know, the defeat of, you know, certain key players like Senator John Arthur Smith and Mary Kay Papin and Ramos and a few others, you know, that were hindering a lot of progress in New Mexico. And while not
conservative
all of
Democrats.
Yeah, exactly. And they all were all Democrats. And while not all of their primary opponents won the general election, unfortunately, I mean, there is still some new blood, some new voices. I mean, I've had a few meetings with some of them in my short time that I've been working with the Sierra Club. But, you know, I mean, like it, there is definitely, there is a feeling of like new blood and accomplishment, I think in the, especially in the Senate. And I mean, you know, we have, Democrats have already had a supermajority. And, you know, just, I really think things are going to get done, and I hope that things get done.
How about the Sierra Club? What are some of your legislative priorities this year?
That is a loaded question because we have several.
I know you have a long list.
We do. But also, you know, I mean, we've been doing a lot of great work with other partners. I mean, like Jessica and Brittany and several others. I think definitely SB 32 trapping. I mean, that one's a huge one. And that's one that I've been really excited for a while, but there's also some other really, really neat ones. You know, like we're, yesterday was the big launch announcement filing of HB 9, which is the Climate Solutions Act, which is a bill that I'm particularly really excited about. That's sponsored by Representatives Melanie Stansbury and Angelica Rubio, as well as the House Speaker Brian Egolf, and then on the Senate side, Mimi Stewart, Benny Shandowit, and Carrie Hamblin. So it is a really, really big collaboration, and it works to address a lot of the, you know, concerns, if that's what you can call it, of transitioning to a cleaner energy. I mean, as we all remember, the governor's executive order was to, you know, set certain standards of basically reducing transmissions and greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. Well, by 2030, you know, down to 50%, and then completely net zero emissions by 2050. So, you know, I mean, New Mexico is a state where, and I mean, oil and gas pays for a lot of stuff. You know, I mean, we have a really big extractive industry. And so this bill kind of works to address some of those, you know, in a sense also by offering, you know, different credit solutions for employers that want to do training, encouraging also to hire locally from New Mexico. I mean, there is a, you know, I've worked a lot with people in Eastern New Mexico that are really concerned about, hey, you know what, like what's going to happen whenever like all these oil jobs go away? Like I've been working on this for, you know, 40 years and maybe my kids are, you know, a part of the oil and gas industry too. You know, so this bill kind of really works to address some of those equity issues. And that's one that I'm particularly really excited about. But we have other really good ones that we're supporting. SB 86, you know, the produced water bill, you know, which again, I mean, you know, just it works to address you know, toxic waste that is produced from fracking. And you know, there's many cases of people that have been affected by these hazardous materials that's in this water, but as well as, you know, neonicotinoid pesticides, and banning those. I think that's super important. I mean, you know, we're losing pollinators such as bees to these pesticides. So this would basically,
I really love that. I can never pronounce it. The neonicotinoid.
Just pronouncing it is a hard word,
but I, you know, I just appreciate that bill so much, and I appreciate the legacy that Senator Mimi Stewart has had for pollinators over many, many years. There have been, you know, iterations of bills and memorials that she's passed in order to protect, you know, bees and butterflies and other pollinators, and they're not one of the more charismatic wildlife species out there, but we all know that they're super important. I know we're all lined up behind Senator Stewart on that.
For the benefit of our listeners who might not know what neonicotinoid pesticides are, can one of you very briefly explain what they are?
I think in a nutshell, it's an insecticide that is used too commonly in growing certain plants for commercial purposes in order to, you know, reduce the pests that might take down those particular plants or crops. But, you know, of course, the insecticides don't always discriminate between what are considered pests and the really important pollinators. So we've seen drastic declines in pollinator populations, and with them being, you know, part of the foundation of our entire ecosystem, it's really important to make sure that those populations survive. So phasing out those, you know, the neonicotinoid pesticides, insecticides, is going to be a key to, you know, helping this planet survive for into the future.
Very important. We'll come back to this topic in a minute, but first we have to take a break. Stay tuned. My guests are Jessica Johnson with Animal Protection of New Mexico, Brittany Fallon with New Mexico Wild, and Luis Guerrero with the Sierra Club Rio Grande chapter. So before the break, we were talking about the class of pesticides that nobody seems to be able to pronounce, neonicotinoid, I believe, which is especially deadly to pollinators. And we were talking about a bill that has been introduced to ban the use of these pesticides in most situations, introduced by Senator Mimi Stewart. And I think, Jessica, you were calling out, drawing attention to how Mimi has become a great champion for wildlife in the legislature. And I think that's absolutely correct. I think she sponsored the wildlife trafficking ban, and I believe she was involved with the wildlife corridors
bill. The wildlife corridors. So, yeah. I mean, how lucky are we to have her as the Senate President Pro Tem now, you know, to have an environmental champion as one of the top Senate leaders? Yeah. It's a really big deal.
And we have, it seems like, a growing number of legislators who are champions for wildlife. I know that Jeff Steinborn is, and Bill Soles, and Matthew McQueen, and Amy Stewart, and a host of others. Encouraging.
So many. And I forget, maybe it was Luis that mentioned Representative Angelica Rubio. She's been able to dig out this really important niche in not only being an environmentalist, but being an environmental justice advocate, and being able to make the connections between safe and healthy land and communities and the disproportionate impacts on people of color, indigenous people, underserved communities. I mean, it's all really a really important conversation to draw attention to, and really kind of unique to New Mexico. So shout out to Angelica on that.
Yeah, completely agree. I mean, that is one of the things I think I admire the most about people like Angelica Rubio, for example. I mean, it is super, super important to address, you know, the inequities when it comes to environmental work, and including people of color and communities of color as well. You know, yesterday at the launch, like Joseph Hernandez was, he's a Dene, and he's part with Native American Voices, and he was talking about it, you know, like this bill addresses like Navajo issues, and it addresses like, you know, Native issues in New Mexico. And I mean, yeah, just like Jessica said, what a unique New Mexico thing, but it's awesome. That's one of the great things about our state.
It is. And this would be, I think, a good point for me to interject, something about the Green Amendment, which hasn't been mentioned yet. A bill to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot in 2022 for the general election. What it does is it amends our state constitution in the Bill of Rights section to establish or guarantee the right of all New Mexicans to a clean and healthy environment. And then it goes on to establish that every level of government has a duty as trustee of the environment as a public trust to manage and protect the environment, including clean water, air, wildlife, ecosystems, for the benefit of all New Mexicans. So it establishes that equity principle right there in the Bill of Rights, the fundamental section. You know, there's a section where the fundamental rights are listed. Senate Joint Resolution 3 is being sponsored by Senator Antoinette Cedillo Lopez up in Albuquerque and Bill Soles down in Las Cruces. On the House side, Joanne Ferrari, another champion of wildlife, Harold Pope, I believe, and Mimi Stewart is a strong supporter of that as well. So I just wanted to mention that, SJR3. Brittany, what's another priority for New Mexico Wild?
We have other legislative bill priorities, but I actually want to talk about something a lot bigger, which is the state budget, because a lot of New Mexicans don't understand how the state budget is put together. Frankly, a lot of legislators don't understand how the state budget is put together. And there is a lot at stake for our daily life there. And in particular, I want to call out our environmental agencies, which are operating in crisis mode because they're so underfunded and so understaffed. One of the things you hear all the time in New Mexico is a lot about how much oil and gas contributes to New Mexico's budget. But you don't often hear that our two state environmental agencies are underfunded by 15 to 30% as compared to where they were 10 years ago when oil and gas production hit record highs. And that's because budget cuts from previous administrations and legislators have left them completely gutted. So for example, these agencies are struggling right now to do what their job is, which is to keep our air and water clean, our food safe, and even rapidly responding to COVID-19 issues with restaurants and businesses like the environmental department does. Another COVID relevant example that's at stake for the environment this session is our state parks division. After reopening last fall, New Mexicans have been flocking outdoors to our state parks only to find them understaffed with limited services, for example, access to bathrooms or trash pickup. And the state parks budget was cut by more than 30% over the past 10 years, which is unacceptable. And in a time where New Mexicans are spending the time outdoors and finding solace in our public lands at a time when we can't gather together, the legislature should be funding our parks at much higher levels to restore the damage that was done, but also to create more opportunities for New Mexicans to enjoy the outdoors now. Calling out what Luis and Jessica mentioned about Angelica Rubio, as she has been a champion of a fund called the Outdoor Equity Fund, which aims to get children of color outdoors to appreciate their heritage and connection to the outdoors. And that fund is up for either a major infusion this session or almost nothing at all this session. And I, for one, think that in a year where our kids have been stuck behind screens in virtual school, isolated from their peers, the state should be investing in getting our children outside to appreciate the lands that New Mexico has to offer.
Absolutely.
I'm glad that Brittany is talking about the budget. I mean, I think a lot of folks who care about the environment, you know, we see problems out there and, you know, it's very easy to immediately think, well, you know, we need to make sure that there's a law to mandate that an agency does this or mandate that a business or a corporation does that. But none of it can work in practice if the enforcing agencies don't have the paid staff that they need to actually implement and carry out the laws. So the budget is dry. I know a lot of people, you know, especially regular folks, don't understand it. But if it's something that you can dig into and pay attention to, it's really, really important.
And I'll touch on one thing. This is an area where any New Mexican can make a big difference. And that's because New Mexico has a really unusual budget process in that when the state is putting together their potential budget for the next year, the governor puts together one budget and the legislature puts together a different budget. And then what happens during the legislative session is that the legislature has to reconcile the governor's budget and their budget into one final budget. And this is very critical because typically the governor's budget is better for environmental agencies. And that is the case this year as well. The governor's budget, for example, fully staffs the State Forestry Department and fully staffs the Oil Conservation Division, which oversees well monitoring and inspections, which is a public health issue. And any New Mexican can contact their legislator to advocate that they adopt, they that their legislator, forgive me, advocate to adopt the governor's budget and support these higher allocations for the environmental agencies that are working so hard to keep us safe.
Absolutely. That brings to my mind, a systemic problem of our budget being so dependent on oil and gas revenues and our tax structure, which I understand is pretty regressive under I don't know all the history, and I don't know if any of you are tracking if there are tax reform initiatives be discussed in Santa Fe. But I know that's a fundamental recurring problem, is how do we diversify our revenue sources away from oil and gas? At the same time, we're trying to pass all this legislation to deal with climate change, and yet we're so dependent on oil and gas for our state budget. Okay, well, we just have a few minutes left. Luis, do you have anything you want to add? Another Sierra Club priority or any final thoughts?
You know, just some final thoughts. I think, you know, again, this session, because of the fact of it being virtual, and sometimes I have to forget to keep my personal feelings aside on the process and how things are working or not working. I think it's just important to remind people just the fact that it's virtual. It is more accessible, I think, than ever before. You know, I mean, there's a lot of people that cannot travel to Santa Fe, as we mentioned before, or cannot be in the Roundhouse for 12 hours. You know, so this is a good time for people to get involved. The Sierra Club has a really, really large number of bills that we are prioritizing. And there's others that we're keeping an eye on and we're interested in, and love to hear from people that want to get involved. We're always looking, we'll train you to lobby your legislators and to give public comment and stuff like that. So yeah, again, I think, you know, everybody needs to participate in this.
Well, how can people get engaged with the Sierra Club on these issues?
Yes, thanks for bringing that up. Best way to do it, I would say, is just go to it's riograndesierraclub.org. That's our website. And, you know, just you can sign up there. You can send me an email at luis.guerrero@sierraclub.org. And I'll connect with me. We've been connecting people with their legislators, and we've been training folks on how to be advocate on the issues that they care about. So, you know, again, we can definitely put you in touch who you need to speak to.
And Jessica, how can people get engaged with Animal Protection of New Mexico?
Yes. So please visit our website, apnm.org. We also do a lot of our legislative work through our legislative arm, Animal Protection Voters. And that website is apvnm.org. We've got information there about Roxy's Law and all the other bills that we're tracking on and taking positions on. I'll also mention, you know, everyone on this panel, including our esteemed host, Kevin Bixby, our organizations are part of a coalition supporting Roxy's Law. And that coalition is called TrapFreeNewMexico.org. And so if you're really interested in that, go to trapfreenm.org.
Thank you. And Brittany, how can people get engaged with New Mexico Wild?
Sure. We are nmwild.org. And when you go to our website, you can see a link to action alerts and priorities. And I also encourage everybody, you don't necessarily have to be involved with an organization to be involved with the legislature. All of the committee hearings and floor sessions are live webcast on the legislative website, nmlegis.org, I think is the nmlegis.gov. And there's also a link on the New Mexico Legislature website to find out who your state legislators are. A lot of people don't know that it's not Yvette Harrell or Ben Ray Lujan. You could put your address in.
It's a great website. I highly recommend it. You can see statutes in the Constitution, find your legislatures, and find legislation. But that's all the time we have for today. I want to thank our guests again, Jessica Johnson with Animal Protection of New Mexico, Brittany Fallon with New Mexico Wild, Luis Guerrero with the Sierra Club Rio Grande Chapter. I also want to thank Michael Allen, our volunteer engineer who makes the magic of radio happen for the show. And I want to thank all of you listeners out there for tuning in.